This is Phil Farron.
And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. Don't think I'm coming in tomorrow. Although there would have been something that I was possibly going to do tomorrow under normal circumstances, but they're actually swapping out my box and finally upgrading me from Windows 7 to Windows 10. I'm the last one in the office because I've been working and they've just left me alone, but we're to the place now that they are going to de-support Windows 7. Microsoft is de-supporting Windows 7 on January the 14th, and so now they're going to go ahead and move me. Well, they're doing that tomorrow when I'm not in the office. We did the big upgrade for K2 from version, well, we, I say that generously. Another man named Justin did a fine job, did a tremendous job getting that done. I just stood on the periphery and went, yay, good job. Anyways, we upgraded the server to 5.3. Everything seems to have been going okay. And in this big final push, where they were really pounding on it, it appears at this point that they are in striking range of getting finished up. I mean, within single digits of getting finished up 2 days early. And so either that means that somebody's going on vacation and they're really trying to get finished up, or it means that the screens had better response time and that actually able to help them get their work done sooner. I have checked in with people who know, and I'm getting responses back that everything's great, everything's working, they aren't getting any complaints, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So it looks like we've actually got that upgrade done, and it looks like it's okay. Yay. Yay. So big hurdle this next week on Monday, we'll be running our normal monthly process that we run, but I tested that on the dev side. It seemed to work fine, so I'm really not anticipating any problems, and even if there are problems, it would be painful, but we could do it by hand. So I think, you know, should be okay. Anyways, so all is well there. We're going fine with the writing. I am a little bit behind because I didn't get my 750 words in last night, but I'm going to try to get caught up with those words tonight. Maybe. I'm trying to decide. Well, first of all, to finish up with the writing, book 11 seems to be received pretty well. People seem to be enjoying it. They're working their way through it, and that's good. They've got a couple of more weeks. The beta readers have a couple of more weeks before it's due. So that all seems to be going fine, and you know, the writing for the new one is going fine. And once I get that under control, that's book 12. So I am cresting. I'm cresting the top of the hill, and it's all downhill from there. Because there's 24 books in the series, so there will be more books behind me and then in front of me once I get 13 done. Anyway, so I'm trying to decide tomorrow if I'm just doing a little mini celebration. This past week, and I didn't even know this, but a fellow programmer came in and said, you might be interested to know. And I was interested to know. Might be interested to know that ARPANET, the birth of ARPANET, was 50 years ago this week. October the 29th, 1969, ARPANET, A-R-P-A, net, N-E-T, was the first attempt to connect computers using a protocol, the TCP/IP protocol. And 50 years ago, on the 29th, on Tuesday, They sent their first packets across, and they were supposed to, if I've got my stories right, they were supposed to send the word login. And in fact, they only got the L and the O transferred before it crashed. So all that came across on the other side was low. As in, lo and behold, which, as it turns out, that was prescient. Because lo and behold, that was the precursor to the internet. And that protocol, as ARPANET continued to grow, eventually spread outwards. I had a buddy ask me today over breakfast. He said, when did you send your first emails? And I was trying to think back, and I told him, well, I think it was sometime in the early 90s I got onto email. I said, although in the late 80s, I remember a buddy of mine telling me about these bulletin board services that you could get on with a modem and connect and dial up. So I have seen it come. I remember life before the internet. I remember life when the internet was fledgling. I remember the explosion of HTML. I remember Google coming online. Before that, AltaVista. AltaVista was the search engine. And then Google showed up with its very austere design, and it took off. I remember Facebook coming online. I mean, it's... I've told people, and I've mentioned this in the past, that I used to be envious of my dad, all the things that he saw come about. But you know, at this point in my life, whoo, stuff that's going on now, goodness, goodness. Knowledge is accelerating. And it remains to be seen where this leads us all. And honestly, this whole election that's coming up, oh, what a zoo this is turning into. This is fascinating. It's going to get more and more fascinating. This is really fascinating. So, it will be interesting to see how all of this goes. But, all is well. We are moving forward. Life is good. Life is good. Life is good. It's good. Wow, it's good. So anyways, I am thinking about doing an ARPANET t-shirt tonight, maybe. Just something real simple. I have a white t-shirt that I got from Michaels at one point, and it's sitting there, and I figure I'm going to get a graphic of a, you know, necktie and or a neck collar and a tie, black, just black. It's a white t-shirt. I'm just going to do black iron on. And then a pocket protector, picture of a pocket protector. Do the same thing, just white t-shirt, iron on. And then I'll probably just put low 50 on there, and then I can explain, you know, about the birth of the internet 50 years ago. So we'll see. I'll see. If I have time to get that done tonight, I'll get it done. I am behind on my words, and of course I do have to do the podcast and, you know, just little things here and there and here and there. But my beloved is in at church tonight. And she's going to be in for trunk or treat tonight, since it is the 31st of October. I will do my normal thing, which is turn out all the lights. We never get any kids coming by, which is fine, because we're out in the country, and yeah, we're never going to get them. So I just turn out all the lights, go downstairs and work. Well, that squirrel isn't going to be contributing to the gene pool. I don't know if you heard the thump or not, but he took out running at the wrong time. So, all is well there. I've had some really interesting conversations. Had an interesting one today with a friend, but... But... I have notes on something else, and I'll probably just do what's on my notes just because it's interesting. It's it's interesting, and it's going to be more interesting to me to see how long it takes the science community, specifically the biologists in the science committee, to let go of their dogma. Obviously, it's been decades and decades and decades, if not centuries, since the biological science community had embraced Darwinism. Before they really understood inheritance mechanisms, how they worked, what their tolerances were, what the rate of mutation was, any of that sort of thing. But the idea that there were random mutations, and then based on those random mutations, those allowed certain populations to prosper, which there is microevolution, there is. And then that was the whole driver to cause all the changes that we see in the animal kingdom. It's the whole thing to cause all the variations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that idea, Darwinism, evolutionary Darwinism, was embraced wholeheartedly and has been embraced for decades upon decades upon decades upon decades. And it's interesting because now that we know more, now that we know that DNA appears to be a kind of instruction manual, a kind of computer program, and typically introducing errors of any significant kind into complex information is not beneficial. That there has been more and more grumbling, soft dissent over the fact that this may not be the whole picture. So I came across this article, and I forgot to change the title. The name of this article was A Unified Theory of Evolution by Michael Skinner was his name. And just to get this right, Michael Skinner is a professor of biological science at Washington State University and the principal investigator at Skinner Laboratory. His research interests include environmental epigenetics and disease etiology. So he is purporting and he is proposing in this article what he calls a unified theory of evolution. And what he means by that is there were actually two huge competing schools of thought when Darwinism first came into being. There was another competing school of thought by a man named Lamarck. And Lamarck believed that environmental pressures could cause changes in animals as well. I think one of his famous examples was, the giraffe needed a longer neck to reach the leaves in the high trees, and so it would stretch its neck out and stretch its neck out, and then when its offspring were born, they had longer necks. Now, there's no evidence that that happens, but the idea was that the environment and the stresses of the environment could actually change how traits are inherited. Once Darwinism came into place, Lamarck, was pretty much poo-pooed and was considered junk science, blah, 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 just kicked out. Of course, then we discover, we analyze and find out the structures of DNA and determine that it's information in the cell. And then beyond that, people start running numbers and they start getting concerned because there doesn't appear to be enough time, even with billions of years, there's not enough time to account for all the variations that we see. People are trying to come up with all kinds of new theories like punctuated equilibrium. There's something, I'm not sure what it is, but there's something that we go along for a while And then there's all these changes. Because there is the Cambrian explosion, which is now being rated between 5 and 10 million years, which of course is a very short amount of time in a biological framework in the history of the Earth. There were all of these new species, all of these new body types, phenotypes, I think they're called, that came into existence all at once within this 5 million year period. And some people say, well, they were just soft-shelled, so we really don't have a record of them. That's really what's going on. And there's, you know, other people that are saying, no, there's really something that's going on here. I'm getting my mail, by the way. One moment. Mail.
Gotta stretch.
What is this? Signing. Sorry we missed you. About delivery. First attempt. Sign. Oop. Which cannot be blah, blah, blah. Redelivery. Sign. Yep, sign on the back. Okay. Oh. Live Well Nutrition Ads. One moment. I think I have to sign on the back here. Okay. Got it. Choose one option. Okay. We'll just put that in there. Anyways, so in the midst of all this, there is also the discovery of something called epigenetics. And that is that it's not just DNA and the expression of DNA that controls what's happening. You can also have this layer on top of DNA that controls the expression of the DNA. And, you know, there's methylation, I think one of the terms is for it. And what's happening there is you're having other compounds that are binding to these DNA sites, and that changes how the DNA is expressed. So you're not actually dealing with mutations, you're dealing with chemical interactions with the DNA. And that, we're still recording. I had put a box down on top of my remote control and I thought, that's bad. Anyways, and so that then becomes yet another way. And in fact, the author of this article is talking about the fact that they have now seen that this epigenetics can be passed on as a genetic trait. So, in fact, there may be a mechanism down deep in there, and that mechanism may allow these traits to be inherited. And, in fact, the author of this article said that they have done research and shown that some of these traits can be inherited out to third, fourth generation. And so this is yet another way that life is adaptive. And you may recall that I have a little saying that whenever someone says, well, evolution this or that evolved or this is evolutionarily, I just substitute that with designed for adaptation. Because in my mind, this is a really good design. I mean, there are variations that you are going to get with mutations that will help animals and life adapt. But now if you have this other thing that can do it as well, that's really cool with the epigenetics. And so the campaign that this guy is trying to push is that, in fact, there may be environmental factors which affect the expression of DNA, and those factors may be inheritable. Well, they are inheritable. They've shown that they're inheritable. What's interesting is that they started publishing some of these findings, and there's been pushback. I mean, pushback. It's not a matter of, oh, that's an interesting finding. Let's see what we can discover about that. Instead of that, there's been like, no, it doesn't work that way. And he says at one point, The unified theory of evolution has many skeptics, especially in light of the genetic determinism paradigm that has influenced the biological sciences for more than 100 years. Genetic determinism sees DNA as the building block of biology and the DNA sequence as the ultimate molecular control. Perhaps the key pentacle of genetic determinism was the sequencing of the human genome, which was to provide the ultimate proof of the primacy of the gene. Genome-wide association studies were predicted to provide biological markers for normal and abnormal phenomena of life and reveal the underpinnings of disease. But in the wake of that sequencing, the major prediction of genetic determinism that the majority of human biology and disease could be understood through the lens of genetics has not borne out. And the two examples he gives are identical twins who suffer from different diseases, and also a section of people who have certain diseases, but when you sequence their DNA, the things that are potential causes for that are different in all the people. So if genetic determinism was absolutely true, you wouldn't find that. Now, okay, that's fine. What's interesting, though, about this, to me, is not that there are other mechanisms for adaptation within the species, because I would expect that out of a well-defined system that was built to adapt to environments so that life could flourish and thrive in a host of situations. It does not surprise me that there are other mechanisms beyond just the slow creep of genetic... I just lost the word. Of genetic mutations. I kept getting manipulations, and I was like, no, it's not manipulations. What is it? It's mutations. It does not surprise me that there are other mechanisms, because you have to adapt. Sometimes you have to adapt quickly. So it would make sense that it would be designed to adapt quickly, and you need other mechanisms. What's interesting to me is that scientists who supposedly only care about the facts, who supposedly only care about proof, only care about what can be scientifically verified, only care about any of that, when you do experiments that show these things, some of them go, nope, because we are all humans and we all get in a rut in our brains. And we all like things to be like we figured out, because we want to believe that we got it first and we got it right and we don't ever have to change our mind about anything. We want to believe all those things. And we want to be reinforced in our beliefs, because that makes us valid and valuable people. So it's interesting to see how this is shifting. Now, does it necessarily mean that it will be easier for them to imagine a creator? I'm not sure that it does, because they would just say, oh, this is just another way that life adapts. And that is an interesting point, too. It doesn't necessarily force them to face the fact that there's a creator. It's just another way for life to adapt. So why shouldn't they just embrace that and say, yeah, let's investigate that and see how that works? But you get this genetic determinism has been the prevalent school of thought. And so people just stick their heels in and they go, no. Because that's what we do as human beings. A lot of times we just don't like change. I mean, we don't like change. So the guy finishes the article by saying a unified theory of evolution should combine both neo-Lamarckianism and neo-Darwin aspects to expand our understanding of how environment impacts evolution. The contributions of Lamarck more than 200 years ago should not be discounted because of Darwin, but instead integrated to generate a more impactful and insightful theory. Likewise, genetics and epigenetics must not be seen as conflicting areas, but instead integrated to provide a broader repertoire of molecular factors to explain how life is controlled. That sounds pretty good to me. I don't know why anybody would necessarily have a problem with exploring that. Granted, there may need to be more studies done and things, but you would just wonder why would there be such a big pushback on that? And really, the only answer I can come up with is it's change, and we don't like change. We like to have everything in our little boxes, and that's the way we want it to be. But of course, there will come a day when we will realize that things are just so complex, so beautiful, so wonderfully balanced, that the only way people will be able to thwart the idea that keeps appearing in their head that there is a designer, the only way they'll be able to stop that is just by getting mad and staying mad all the time. And pounding their podiums and saying, no, it's not. No, it's not. La, 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 la. Yeah. But we'll see how long it takes us to get to that point. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.